Hello, fellow travelers, and welcome to the Diverse in the Stars podcast. How are my loyal listeners? Thank you for continued support. And as always, hit that subscribe button, everybody. We had an amazing show for you all, because Born the Mothership is Dan Reba. You know him as the storyboard artist and director of some of your favorite animated series, like Batman, the animated series, Superman, Justice League, Justice League Unlimited, and way more. Now come join me as we go traversing the stars. Hello, Mr. Reba. Thank you so much for coming to Traversing the Stars podcast.
Thank you for having me.
It's totally my pleasure, sir. You have been a very important part of my childhood growing up.
Well, that's nice to hear.
And it's actually true. So what inspired your love for animation and who your earliest influences?
Oh, boy. You love cartoons all your life. So it's a difficult thing to say, you know, from Astro Boy to Walt Disney to Hanna-Barbera, you know, all of that stuff, like Johnny Quest, all those things had a firm plant in my brain when I was very little. I also love comics, too. So I had an older brother who collected comics, and they were always in the house. So I always knew of Batman and Superman and then the rise of the Marvel age, like from a very young age. So and my early influences would probably be, well, I guess, you know, Jack Kirby and probably the Dick Sprang reprints in Batman and Carl Barks and the Harvey comics. So those things were things that I'd read when I was little. So
having been such a big part of animation for such a long time, and also been a fan of animation since we were younger, what would you say it's been the biggest changes in animation over the span of the last few decades?
Probably the difference between broadcast and cable. And then after that, the technological differences, where you know the end of cel paint and the beginning of computers, that also changed the spectrum. But really, it was like who cartoons were made for, and people growing up and adults watching cartoons. That may have been the case earlier, but it wasn't like people, you know. It wasn't perceived that way. It was always perceived as a children's medium when I was growing up, and then with the advent of cable and more stations directly funding cartoons, it became a different animal. You know, you weren't always funded by cereals and toy commercials and things like that we were when the business kind of started.
I kind of feel like you and Batman MA series had a major part in taking cartoons more seriously. I mean, there's always Flintstones, who I think was prime time for a little while in the 60s, but for the most part, I feel like Batman was that serious shit when people looked at it from as adults and gone, this isn't a kid's show, or at least it works as a non-kid's show more than anything before, like Transformers, G.I. Joe, things of that nature.
Right. And that was, you know, to some degree by design, but not really, because, you know, from when it's on during the day, people, you know, they want to sell to kids. So that is, but they knew that it was skewing to adults as well. So they tried to run it on prime time. In fact, the premiere was on a prime time special. And the funny thing about that was that it wasn't sponsored by cereals. There were car ads and like a Playtex bra ad on. and I was like, what? That's not a cartoon sponsor usually.
Right, right.
So that was really cool. That was really cool.
So in your opinion, did Batman the Animated Series shift the opinion to taking cartoons seriously? Or was the atmosphere, especially around Batman, because the movie had come out, begin to be taken more seriously, once again, because of that movie and Tim Burton's influence?
Well, there are two different things in terms of like how Batman is taken seriously or how animation is taken seriously.
I guess my thought was that one kind of caused the other. Batman being taken seriously started getting cartoons to take more seriously.
Well, Sure. Because up until the Tim Burton film, even though it's stylized and extreme, and it wasn't campy in a traditional, Adam West sense. And so it did change the way people viewed Batman, the way that people viewed Superman differently after the Donner film. It was okay for adults to like Superman. And the Tim Burton Batman film made it okay for adults to like Batman again. And we benefited tremendously from that, because A, it was success, and they wanted a cartoon tie-in with their successful film, but also because the perception, we could get away with not having a campy kid show. And everybody was on board with that. The network realized that we had to actually have action come back, and that was something that, from the first 10 years of my business, my working in the industry, everything, the standards and practices always, were sort of skewing things into a manner that made it very difficult to do anything with action. No guns were ever allowed. No hitting, no punching, no actual violence. There's so many rules that neutered cartoons of that kind of nature, so that you couldn't really tell a decent story. They were always, it was really, you see how hard it was to make a good Super Friends cartoon, and people tried. Alan Burnett managed to write Batman's origin and did it without showing a gun, and it's extraordinary how they actually kind of pulled it off with all the limitations of the standards and practices at that time. But we had an ally in Fox. We had an ally in Gene McCurdy, and everybody was sort of like on the same page of making a cartoon that was well, that wouldn't betray Batman.
Well, I read an interesting fact, and let me know if it's true. I read that you were the DC's animated universe's longest serving director. Did you ever envision that you'd have that much longevity into this one universe? And what was it like playing in that sandbox for you?
It's funny, because I don't know if that's true anymore. I think that Sam Liu and a couple other guys have been there for just about as long as I was. It's just that I was there at the beginning, and that made it, that made it different, at least with the Batman franchise. Let's see, what's the second part of your question again?
And what has it been like to be able to play in that sandbox for as many years as you have?
It was a dream come true. It was like I went to School of Visual Arts. Will Eisner was a teacher. I wanted to either do comics or animation. I studied to do both. I came out to California, Ruby Spears. I was working at Ruby Spears. Jack Kirby was there. Doug Wildey was there. It was a dream to actually like interact with people, that I idolized, and then to get the privilege of working on Batman and then later Superman. This is no small thing. It's a big deal, and I took that seriously. These are all childhood dreams that you get to interact with and play with other people's toys, essentially, in their sandbox. And it was a dream. It was a dream.
I think the part that caught me the most is that you were taught by Will Eisner, who is one of, just like Jack Kirby, one of the legends of the world of comic books. What was that like? I mean, what was he like as a teacher for you? What was it, did he make you feel confident you're being taught by one of the legends, or did it make you feel like the pressure of, I gotta impress this guy, the great Will Eisner?
That was that. There was a little bit of that, but he was a good guy. He made it easy in that sense. I just feel like he wrote so many books now about all the stuff that everything that he ever said in class is out there on, they're all in the books. It's all there. The thing that isn't in the books are his critiques of your work, and his when you'd send him assignments, and he would like, do this and do this and change this to this, and You know, he had the tendency to sort of focus on how he was telling stories. Now, you'd like to do these sort of classical stories the way that, you know, the way he used to do it. And he was like, no, how about this, vignetting this or doing this? And you don't need a panel here. You can, and he was kind of like trying to get you to do stuff the way he does them now, as or then at that time, as opposed to how he did them in the 40s. So that was an interesting thing working, you know, with him, having him as a teacher.
Well, that's really also that there was for him too that level of growth and how he viewed the more recent comic books. You would think that someone who's been writing for so many years and successfully would be stuck in that format in their head, but the fact, I guess, he was
Oh,
adapting
he was
so
always
quickly.
growing. He was always growing. He was always, yeah. No, it was amazing. Oh, he is. And he was just a force of nature. I mean, I remember, you know, following him out of the school, like talking about something, and he was taking a train, and he had his big, heavy briefcase portfolio thing that he carried around with him. And I offered to carry it. No, he's like, no, I can handle this, you know. And it's like he had so much energy and so strong. It was like he'd play tennis on the weekends and do all sorts of physical stuff. So he was actually in really great shape. So, yeah, it was.
So if you had to like encompass the primary lesson from the experience at the visual arts school, what would have been that was like the main thing that you took away from that?
Oh my. But that's an, I don't know. I really don't know. I mean, I guess, you know, just sort of the confidence in your own work and the ability to tell a story. I mean, I kind of, you know, didn't really. It's funny, you grow up in comics and you think that stuff is innate, and it kind of is, but you don't really articulate it in your head how it's done. And people go, no, this is kind of a rule, and this is a rule, and you should think about this, and you should think about, and those are the things that you kind of like, oh yeah, of course, that's it. And just kind of doing it, you build up more confidence. So that when I went to Ruby Spears and they gave me a script and some storyboard panels, and you know, they'll look at your portfolio, but they're like, yeah, but can you really do this? And I had no samples of storyboarding, so they just gave me a script, gave me some pages. They got and went off to lunch, let me draw, and I didn't finish the entire, you know, 2 pages they had. I was like, oh my gosh, I failed this miserably. I only did like four storyboard pages, but they all had like 6 panels each at that time. So there was a lot of panels. And they came back after lunch and went, oh my gosh, this is fine. This is great. No, you're in. And I'm like, but I didn't finish. I'm like, no, you're supposed to finish. Nobody finishes. That's like, so that was, you know, and it was like school helped me, you know, with the confidence and speed and all of that stuff to kind of, it's cool.
So, since, as you said, you began as a storyboard artist and a character designer, so how did that evolve into later directing? Is the skills that it takes to be a good storyboard artist similar to being a good director?
Well, sure. It just encompasses more. That's all. And I had actually directed when I was a deke for ALF and Super Mario Brothers and a couple other things. So it wasn't like I didn't have experience. But I just when Batman came on, I didn't think it. I didn't. I knew it wasn't going to be an easy show, and I knew I had the skills, but I didn't want to take the time to do it because I had stuff going on in my life, and I knew it was going to be like a all, you know, around the clock kind of job. And so I didn't even ask for the job initially. When Kevin Altieri called me up and go, hey, you gotta get over here, they're doing a Batman cartoon, and I had already seen the promo, so I wanted to be in on that. So when I went to the to meet Bruce, I was expecting to do boards, but he's like, no, we have enough board artists, we need character designers. And I had just done some character designs on a Little Nemo in Slumberland project for TMS, and so because I had model sheets in my portfolio, he looked at that and went, oh yeah, you can do this, he can, you know. And I was like, yeah, but you know, some of these are based on the work of Dave Feast, so you know, he had some animation drawings, and I kind of like, you know, but, and he's like, no, that's fine, because you're going to be basing it off of my style, so you know, it means you can, you know, you can fine, it's fine, fine. So that was my first day. It was just like, yeah, get it, just here, boom, you're a character designer now. So, and then occasionally, like when Kevin needed help, I'd help clean up boards. I did some storyboard cleanup on Leather Wings, and I bordered a little bit on POV, and then I bordered some on the first Riddler show, and then I helped Bruce clean up on Laughing Fish because he had a big job that he bordered almost the whole thing. He thumbnailed and roughed the first part, and then boarded the last act himself, but then like half the studio, half the crew, like helped clean up the board, and it was really, really a beautiful board. It was really fun.
So, where did the confidence come from to then direct? What was it? Did you ask, or did they ask you?
It the way that worked it was that Dick Sebast left the show. He had a better project coming up for him that he thought was better. And he decided he was tired of the commute and this and that, and so he left. And Kevin, who knew I had directed at Deke, and he was like, "Oh, Kevin, Dan can do this, Dan." And he kind of talked me up behind the scenes while this is all going on, while Dick is quitting and all this stuff. I get a call from Ann Lighting, and I go into Bruce's office, and they offer me the job, to take over for Dick's crew for the remainder of the season. And I finished on Zatanna, and because I had a storyboard to finish there, the show was short. I had to help that finish that off. I did layouts for What Is Reality, and but then my first show by myself was Blind as a Bat, and that was a Penguin show that was really, really fun to do.
So, once again, as being one of the main pioneers on a Batman animated series, what were the early conversations like about the series? What do you guys talk about amongst the creative team? Was there discussions of, oh my God, we're pushing the envelope here, or was it just this is the job we're doing it?
What we Nobody actually says that while they're working on something. You don't actually like, oh, we're gonna, but you just kind of do it. You innately kind of go, this has got to be this, and you push it as far as you can. BS&P was really kind. They let us get away with a lot, but there were things that we still weren't allowed to do. And you pull back because you understand you still have to air this as a kid show. And there were ways around it. They let us kind of, there were things that we did where we'd punch at camera, so we couldn't actually show a fist connecting with a face. They were really big on that. So that's why there was a lot of Batman punching at the camera and flashing white, because that was stuff was like, or kicks, because they weren't defined as to where the contact was. And if we did do that stuff, we had to make sure it wasn't to a jaw or chin, whatever. And I think that's why when we did Mask of the Phantasm, the very first thing Bruce did was show a guy getting punched in the jaw. His hand goes screw, because we were trying to do all the little things that we weren't allowed to do on Saturday morning or weekday,
I never noticed that at all. I gotta now watch it and pick up on that. I never noticed that Phantasm was like the first Batman that got to really knock someone in the jaw.
I mean, there are places where we got away with it where they didn't notice. I said, there's things like, oh, you can't have him break a window and go through glass. Well, if you look at the Riddler show, they go through a skylight and there's glass. It's the way we shot it, where you don't actually see them breaking through the glass, but and they just they were they were sticklers about, oh, how if the glass all lands first and it doesn't land on anybody, and because they always the imitatable behavior, and all that stuff takes, and we were allowed to have guns, which nobody else was allowed to have. G.I. Joe, X-Men, they all had to have ray guns and shoot laser beams and stuff. And for some reason, as long as the guns were not super realistic, we had this sort of blocky shape where they were sort of stylized. But they were still, you could tell that's a 45 and that's a revolver, and they all kind of looked in the realm of real, but they were still stylized. But they clearly showed, were real bullets, and they let us do it.
I think one of the funniest things in about Batman and a lot of cartoons was that once again you couldn't show anyone really get hurt. There's like the scenes where the truck is like driving off a bridge and he falls into the ocean. The guys get out and they're like, is that a better message? A better message to them if they showed that, you know, there's danger in trying these things? What did you think about that?
Well, I think that it becomes ridiculous after a while because, you know, you have a guy fall out of a car that Batman has you know skewed on the front of the Batwing, and he lands in a swimming pool on a rooftop, and you're like, well, did he intend for that, or how does that work? Or you have I was looking at Zatanna again, and the two thugs fall off the plane and they fall thousands of feet into water, and you're like, oh, but it's okay because they landed in water, but it really they would kind of they'd be dead. But because, you know, we see them splash and it's water, you know, we can assume that they survived. So, you know, but again, we do these as efforts to, like, okay, we're not showing somebody die. You know, the network's, oh, okay, you know, we didn't want to have parachutes on everybody like they had to do on G.I. Joe when planes explode and stuff, because yeah, that's the only way to have them survive. And there's sometimes we accidentally kill people. There were explosions and things that we'd forgotten to get people out of a vehicle, a police that, you know, jump out of a blimp and fire from Olympus. And you're like, okay, he jumped out, but there's a huge fireball. I'm like, I don't know if he made it, even though it happens off camera. And you know, we didn't plan for that. We didn't intend to, like, oh, we're gonna kill this guy. It just, you know, we're thinking, okay, he got out here, so he's safe. Yeah, well, whatever, you know, maybe not. But, you know, but we didn't kind of like, we don't really set out to, like, oh, now we're gonna kill these guys for real. Not really, no, you know, and not until Mask of the Phantasm, you know, and then that's, you know, so.
Which is one of my favorite movies. I must admit, I think Mask of the Phantasm may be still the best Batman movie ever made. And only because it's a cartoon, I think people don't rank it that, but I think it should be.
Yeah, I think it's awfully good. The only thing I kind of think, even though I have nothing to do with it, I think the Return of the Joker, Batman Beyond film has better animation, and it's a really compelling story. It's really well told, but it's also, like, phenomenally well animated. Whereas Mask of the Phantasm has some wonderful spots. There's some beautiful, terrifying scenes, and I think it's there's some great stuff in it. But overall, I think the animation is a little more TV.
You know, something I always wonder about the Mask of Phantasm. There's moments in the Mask of Phantasm where it looks like a different type of art is being done. Like there's a moment where he's raising the binoculars to his eyes, and it looks like something slightly different is happening in the animation. Is that just in my head, or did you guys, is that a computer, and why did you choose certain scenes to be done differently?
Let's see. Why stuff looks different. Is that, wait, can again?
There's certain moments in the Mask of Phantasm where it looks like almost like it went from an animation to almost computer. It has a different element or appearance to it. Sort of like the scene that always gets surprises me is the one where Bruce Wayne or Batman is looking through the binoculars and he has a close up then of the binoculars going up to his eye, and it looks like something's different. And like they did a different type of animation for certain moments like that. Is it in my head or is that a real thing?
It's in your head, but it's also a thing that we used to do on the TV show a lot, where we used to have, you know, still paintings of Batman, you know, rendered paintings, and then have animation on top of that. So we do that. You know, it's in the title sequence. It's in several shows where you'd see something, and we just do a painting, a flat painting of something, but it'd be beautifully rendered. And I think that's what you're responding to, because it's like he's a rendered face, but he's got, like, animated rain coming off of him, and he's got the binoculars going. So what's funny about that scene, by the way, now that you brought that scene up, was that the whole point of that scene is that he's reading their lips through the binoculars, and the whole idea of, like, long distance reading of lips was kind of inspired by the compositions in 2001, where HAL 9000 is reading the lips of the astronauts that are, like, talking about conspiring to deactivate him. And they did this really cool, like, close up of their lips and they're talking, and we kind of, like, it was one of these things where we kind of based it loosely on that. We were trying to figure out what's the best way to show this, and it came up with a composition that was similar. And then I was talking to Gary Lockwood, who starred in the film, and he actually said that that was his idea, and he had suggested it to Stanley Kubrick. And it was really weird because I'm like, wait, and we borrowed that concept for Mask of the Phantasm, so that's kind of cool.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
So as director, you must have worked with some amazing voice talent like Kevin Conroy, Tim Daly. I think you also worked with Mark Hamill and Dana Delaney. What is it like working with that talent?
Well, it's wonderful because everyone you name it are just they give so much to the cartoon. When you have somebody whose work is so strong that their voice inspires the storyboard artists and the acting, and then later the animation and the layouts and all that stuff are all inspired by listening to the voice. And when you have the really strong, iconic voice that works with the character, it's nothing better. That's half your work is done. So, it's great. It's great.
I think one of my favorite episodes of the entire DC animated universe is Epilogue in Justice League Unlimited.
Wow. Cool.
That one is something so great, and especially that ending with Batman and Ace. When and I mean, how did that all come about? Like, what was it like to be a part of that?
Well, and keep in mind, when we did that, we thought that that was going to be the end of our DC animated universe. That had been slated to be the last episode. So it was our goodbye to that world. So we wanted to reflect on the origin and the beginnings of Batman as much as possible. It's yeah, there's a lot of stuff in that episode. The layers, it's so many layers of things. There's a shot of Terry holding a phone, and we borrowed the composition from a big little book artist named Henry Villaly, who drew a guy sitting a cop sitting at a phone, and that pose became Bob Kane swiped it basically. He traced it off for the pondering Bruce Wayne, wondering about the criminals are a superstitious lot, and he's got this close up of Batman thinking or Bruce Wayne thinking, and that's what it's from. It's from this book. So we used that same illustration. I gave it to the board artist, and he actually put the character in exactly that same pose to sort of reflect the origins of the origins of
Oh,
the origins.
wow. That's awesome.
Yeah. And then we, if you watch, the last shot is an echo of the first shot of On Leather Wings, where Man-Bat Shadow is flying around Gotham, and a blimp flies past, flies into, what's that flashing on the radar screen? And it's they think it's Batman, but it's Man-Bat. And in this case, we did, a flyby, and it's like now it's like a little, it's not a blimp, but it's a little, flying police car that's over Gotham, and it's like, what's that flashing? And the cop that says that was Kevin Conroy, who had the first line in On Leather Wings. He plays the pilot, the blimp pilot.
Oh, wow, I did not know
So
that.
we're ending the way we began.
That's
And
awesome.
when Kevin read that, he laughed because he knew exactly what we were doing, and he said it exactly the same way. He had the, it was so cool. So,
Oh, that is
what's that
awesome.
flashing? What's that flashing? It's
I did not know that. That's awesome that you tied the trailer that well.
yeah. So if you watch it again, you'll see that that's what we were doing at the very end. We were sort of reflecting the beginning of the DC animated universe. And I really love the whole, storyline with Ace, to showing how tender Batman could be, the sensitive, and it was a really wild. There's so many in jokes and things in that also. Each of the Royal Flush Gang are sort of, it's all, they're all puns. They're visual puns. So you'll, if you watch carefully, you'll see like what each of them, the Queen, the King, the Jack is a. It was if Phil Lamar did the voice of the Jack And he's a samurai, so it's Samurai Jack. So,
That's awesome. That's awesome.
and he's Samurai Jack. So there was like a pun joke there. Ten is based on Bo Derek. You know, she's got the dread. She's got hair like Medusa, but they're in dreadlocks. So, but it's from the Blake Edwards movie Ten, Bo Derek. You know,
Oh, wow.
so
Okay.
that was our visual pun there. So it was
Now,
they're all pretty cool.
if I remember correctly, and correct me if I'm wrong, the queen, when it transforms, is actually a guy, which at the time would have been was actually quite surprising that that was done. Because nowadays it'd be normal, but back then I'd be like, I was like, oh my God, that's a surprise that that they have that twist.
Well, yeah, you noticed it essentially we were basing that queen on Divine, the John Waters, Pink Flamingos,
Oh, yes.
so who was also the inspiration for Ursula in Little Mermaid.
Oh, wow.
So that was another thing that
I mean, was that intentionally trying to be socially conscious that you're trying to,
it's a
the
pun.
message? It's a
It's a
pun.
pun. It's a pun.
Okay.
And I'm not going to say it because it's like, but it's a drag queen,
Yes, indeed.
it's that kind of queen,
But and it's like I said, that episode I've watched so many damn times. I mean, it's one of those things where when I have the DVD, have it, I think bought on Amazon, I watch that so many times. And I really do think one of the coolest things is when you think about Batman and Batman over the course of those animated episodes, right? He's always shown as being like the dark, stoic guy. But in Epilogue, they do, as you mentioned, talk about his compassion and that in many ways he's the most compassionate. And I thought that was a fascinating way to be like a final thought on that character.
It was. And the other thing that's interesting is that plot line that it's very controversial. Alan Burnett hates it. He doesn't like the idea of Terry McGinnis having genetic connection to Batman, and it is one of those things where I love the idea because I think it's kind of cool. But I get why people don't. You don't really, you want there to be some things that aren't connected, that things are always destined to be this way, and it gets boring. But in this case, it kind of made sense. It really did. And actually, like Bruce and Glenn had come up with the idea as a sequel plot to Return of the Joker, but since that did not fly off the shelves at the time, the studio wasn't really behind it. They weren't able to do that. So at that point, it would have been a different plot, but it was going to be the same idea that they find out that Terry is kind of a clone of Bruce, or at least had the same DNA. But this worked better, and the idea that Amanda Waller was the one behind it, and it made so much sense. It made so much sense the way that the series had progressed, that this actually played. But it was an old
Yeah,
idea.
well, another part that I thought was really ingenious is that once again you include the phantasm, give like a little nod to to her in
Yes.
the movie. That was once again in the episode. That was just very genius as well, because
Yeah.
I kind of wish that character had showed up more
Yeah.
in the Batman stories.
I know. Me too. Me too. You always feel, whatever happened to Andrea,
Yeah.
she's still around. I mean, that's the cool thing about it is that we acknowledge, she's still alive in the future. So,
Apparently, she never got over it. She held that grudge a long time.
yeah. Well, I mean, but the idea was, I don't, who knows? She's not running around as a phantasm. That's something that like Amanda Waller like was conspiring with her to make her do this thing, and she refused, So,
So, are you able to discuss a little bit what you're working on now, or can you hint at anything?
I honestly, I'd rather not.
Fair
I'm
enough.
sorry. It's a new project, and it has been announced, and I have been, but I can't go into detail about it. So I'd almost I'd you know and I just had a thing where, but. Yeah.
But
It's
when you're ready to talk about it, you come back on. I want to talk about it, please.
all right. Oh, please. Yeah, I will. I will. Absolutely.
Well,
Absolutely.
like I said, I just want to. I think every fan of Batman and the DC Animated Universe owes you a debt of gratitude for being such important parts of our childhood. And now I get childhood, I guess I'm in my early 40s now, so I guess it's kind of into my adulthood too. I still watch them all. I still watch Justice League, Justice League Animated, Batman Beyond, and I watch all of them. And I just thank you. You're in there's fantastic. And my last question, I guess, for you would be, did you think when you were doing them that people like me 20, 30 years, you know, later would be still watching?
Yes, I did. And I have proof because there's a magazine article at where they interviewed me back when we were working on the show. And I was like, something about, you know, I think it's amazing to think that I'm working on something that's going to last forever. And I knew because I was a fan, and I knew the way I felt about Space Ghost and Johnny Quest and things like that that had ingrained themselves into my life, or the Adam West Batman, for crying out loud. Those things, like they become a part of your life and you don't forget them. And I knew that this show would have lasting appeal because I knew, you know, I loved what we were doing. You just know that it's good, and this has to connect with somebody else, you know. And when you go to an editing room and watch a show and it makes you cry, you're like, well, that's different, you know. It was like, you know, with like the Robin's Reckoning, and that was the thing where I didn't even direct that show, but I helped to edit it. And when we were in the editing room, it was so emotional. And then Baby Doll was like another one of those ones that was so powerful. You're just really, really lucky to have that opportunity to work on these things.
And, like I said, thank you so much. And Mr. Reba, it was a pleasure talking with you, sir. And welcome back, and we'll be glad to talk about more stuff. That's awesome.
Cool. Yes, I will. And when I can talk about my project, I will. It's just I might be able to name it, but I'd rather, you know, be able to like freely talk about more aspects of it. So, you know.
Well, the door.
Okay. Cool. All right. Thank you. You too. Take care. Okay.